Hey, this is Peter Biello, host of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. It's really important to have a news roundup like this every week because the news moves so quickly. We need time to process it, and the roundup helps us do that. If you use and enjoy this podcast, please support it in an amount that's right for you. Make a gift of $10 or $20. Give now at nhpr.org or just follow the link for the show notes. All right, here's the roundup.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. Molly Kelly lands a big endorsement in her bid for the Democratic nomination for governor. A report looking at the future of health care for New Hampshire's military veterans gets the okay from Washington. And some New Hampshire communities challenge the way the state funds education. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. And you can call into the Exchange with your questions or comments. 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we are also streaming a live video of this radio show, so it's very easy to listen and watch. You can check out the stream at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here.
Hi, Peter.
Thank you.
So, again, the phone number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. We're going to start the show this week by talking about Molly Kelly and the big endorsement she got from the state chapter of the National Education Association. And we'll start with you, Dean.
Sure.
How big a deal is this endorsement?
It's certainly a nice endorsement to have. And it's sort of more broadly speaking, Molly Kelly has, in very short order, lined up a pretty impressive list of endorsements. Pretty much every kind of Democratic institutional elite in the state, U.S. senators, Democratic leadership at the state house. So she's got an increasingly long list of endorsements. You know, the impact of these endorsements, you know, there's debate in political science about just how much endorsements matter. You know, if nothing else, it's going to give her some increased visibility, could help her with fundraising. It's a form of signaling from Democratic elites about who they're putting their stock behind in terms of running for governor. Having a union endorsement often helps with get out the vote activities during the election. It's additional manpower to help you organize. So certainly a good thing for her. I mean, it does give Steve Marchand the option to kind of pitch her as an old school Democratic insider, kind of more the same argument as he tries to foster support in the grassroots among the state's progressives. So certainly not a bad thing. She's got a lot of them. It could help her in some respects. In the end, whether it's going to be decisive, I'm not so sure about that. But she keeps lining them up one after the next.
Trent?
It makes me think, but, remember back to 2015 and Hillary Clinton and what happened there, right? Hillary Clinton seemed like she had New Hampshire locked up. She had all the Democratic establishment type people in supporting her. A lot of the same people who are supporting Molly Kelly now supported Hillary Clinton. These are some of the smartest people, some of the smartest Democratic operatives in the state who know how to win elections. And she still lost the New Hampshire primary by 22 points. And so that's people who are watching this race are wondering whether history is going to repeat itself. Steve Marchand is certainly going for some of those Bernie voters, right? He is positioning himself as the more progressive person. Not that Molly Kelly isn't liberal on her own. I mean, she has a long record of being a progressive. So that's one thing we'll be watching in this race is that Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party still alive and well? And Are they open to somebody else besides Bernie, like Marchand?
Right. Well, that's the question. Will the choice of one Democrat over the other have any real impact in terms of the rates at which those folks turn out, either at the September primary and certainly in the November general election? And I've said before on the show that I think in the end, if you look at the metrics by which we traditionally decide whether or not a governor is going to get reelected in the state, Chris Sununu is in pretty good shape by most traditional mess approval, et cetera. However, what's going to matter is whether or not there's a blue wave of some sort, how big it is, and that could have as significant an impact on Governor Sununu getting reelected as who the actual Democratic candidate is. I think that's a useful exercise for the Democratic Party in the state. Whether it's going to have a huge impact on whether or not he gets reelected, I think there are a lot of other sort of larger factors about what's going on in the country and what's going on in the state in terms of a backlash to President Trump. It's also a midterm election. That's going to have a big impact as well on whether or not Governor Sununu gets reelected.
We got this question from Katie, who emailed us, exchange@nhpr.org, by the way, is the email address. Katie writes, how important are endorsements really? I'd love to see some statistics, not just opinion, about whether endorsements actually produce votes versus House meeting and the type of retail New Hampshire politics that Marchand is doing. Dean, you alluded to earlier the debate.
This has been a long-standing debate in political science.
But are there statistics?
Yeah, there are. I don't have any at my fingertips. I can tell you my general impression from years of reading this stuff is that it's pretty mixed. We get into a lot of discussions about whether newspaper endorsements really matter. These kinds of, as Trent was suggesting, there's no guarantee just because you get the institutional elites behind you that's going to transfer to turnout and support among the grassroots. It could help you with getting out the vote, but it's not at all a guarantee. So, and there's always a danger of kind of having yourself being painted as kind of this sort of institutional insider, which may make some movement progressives want to stay home. I don't know that that's going to happen, but that's sort of part of the discussion. So I think it's in general, sort of historically, it's kind of a mixed record.
And think about this. So in this race on the Democratic primary for governor, there's probably going to be 100,000, 125,000 people who vote out of a state of 1.3 million. So you have to think, all right, what percentage of those people can you actually knock on their door, right? How many people can you actually hit with a phone call or a mailer versus how many people can a union turn out for you or somebody like Senator Shaheen, who has a lot of experience and has a big campaign list of people who support her and that and how many. So the question is, how many of those people can those unions and all that support turn out versus how many doors can you knock on? And I think it depends, right? I think what we saw with Bernie and I think what Marchand's trying to do is he was able to reach people through the internet. And so it was, faster, easier and cheaper. But in these primaries, especially I think in this primary where there's not going to be a ton of attention on it, having that support, that union support, and these endorsements, I do think
can
help
get out the vote. Absolutely, can also help you with fundraising, and maybe a little bit of a different story in the general election. But I've had conversations with a few Democrats who are trying to decide, kind of sort of game out which candidate is likely to have a bigger impact on overall turnout, and there are sort of varying opinions on what exactly the kind of progressive crowd in the state, which turned out quite strongly for Bernie in the primary, in New Hampshire primary, what they will likely do in the September primary for governor and also this November.
Molly Kelly, by the way, will be joining us for the full hour on the exchange on Tuesday of next week. So if you have questions for Molly Kelly about her campaign or policy ideas, send them by email now. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also in the news this week, Trent, state officials reversed direction on a new policy that would have prevented members of the public from attending adult parole board hearings or obtaining audio recordings of them. What prompted this discussion, Trent?
Well, a local reporter. Todd Feathers, who's a new reporter at the Union Leader, had been doing some reporting about the parole board. He attended a couple of parole board hearings. And there were a number of stories both in New Hampshire and nationally about a parolee who had been released from a New Hampshire prison and then went on to allegedly murder his fiancée. And so there was some criticism of the parole board. And immediately after those stories ran, including a story, a big takeout from Todd, the parole board said, hey, you know what? We're going to take a look at our rules again. And, the right to know law actually doesn't allow us to open these to the public. And so they had changed the and there's some debate about whether the procedure had actually been changed or whether they were still debating it. But Todd Feathers, a reporter at the Union Leader, called and said, hey, can I come to the next parole board meeting? Can I obtain audio recordings of prior parole board hearings. And he was told by the executive secretary there, no, you're not allowed to come to parole board meetings. Parole board meetings are now only going to be open to victims, and victims can only come and testify. They can't watch the proceedings. Hmm. And as Todd, that day, as Todd was working on the story, he started making all these phone calls. He called the attorney general's office, the ACLU, some victims' rights advocates. And as it was kind of getting out there, the attorney general heard what was going on and had the associate attorney general, Jane Young, essentially put a stop to this. So between the point the morning when Todd started working on the story and the end of the day when he had to file, the policy had been suspended. And so the parole board will no longer be closing their hearings. They are going to be reviewing their procedures to make sure that they're falling in line with state law, but it is not going to be an immediate thing.
So were you saying that it is legal under the right to know law to close these meetings, but the policy was to leave them open anyway for the sake of public information?
Well, and I think that's what they're trying to interpret, right? I think there are different opinions about it. There was an original opinion from an assistant attorney general that said the right to know law does not allow for the parole boards to be open. Many other people interpreted that in a different way. They say the ACLU, for example, victims' rights advocates say absolutely the right to know law. The right to know law allows these to be open. As you know, RSA 91A is always open to interpretation, and people are always arguing about what exactly it means. And that's kind of one of the big flaws of the law. But in this case, the attorney general is now going to be taking a look at it to make sure that it is falling within the law.
Just real quick, the bigger picture here, we can go back to the debate over Marcy's Law here in New Hampshire, the idea that, some advocates argue that, the system as it currently exists, and this is an example, really favors the offenders over the potential victims, then you need to kind of maximize transparency and a right to know so that the larger community, the victims and victims' families have full information going into whether it's a trial or a parole board hearing.
And can you articulate for me the argument for closing these to the public? Like, whose interests are protected if these are closed?
Well, I don't know.
It's hard to
say. That's very hard to say. They've traditionally been open. And there's been a fight along the way. And in the last 10 years, there's been a fight to open them up to recordings and then open them up to video cameras. We are right now one of the most transparent states when it comes to parole. You can go, reporters can go, members of the public can go, people can testify, you can tape record, you can video record, and that process has been working. And what was surprising to us and surprising to a lot of the people who tipped us off to this was that a month after the parole board made this decision to let out this person who then went on to commit murder and then received some critical press about it, for some reason after, I don't know how many years of this process being completely open to the public, just weeks after the stories hit the press, all of a sudden, oh, no, we can't have these public anymore.
All right. Well, this is a story I know the journalists in the room will be interested in following, but the public, too, I'm sure. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And still to come, we'll be talking about voting. We talk about voting a lot on this show, but we'll talk maybe a little bit about ranked choice voting, which Maine gave a try this week. We'll look at how it's gone there. Also, we'll talk about the use of absentee ballots. Democrats want to expand the reasons for requesting one. Have you had a need to request an absentee ballot, but maybe the reason you needed one wasn't legal? Give us a call. Let us know what you think. 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We had some news on the opioid front this week. The numbers weren't great. We expected them to be high. A total of 487 people died in New Hampshire from drug use in 2017. That's up by just 2 in 2016. But was this increase a surprise, Dean? Was there anything surprising about this number?
Well, some of the reporting I read actually kind of presented it as a little bit of a moderation in the spiking of deaths. But it's still obviously it's the highest we've seen in a decade, nonetheless, even though it's just two up from 2016 to 2017. And there's, some concern now. We've also hearing from treatment centers and that with this with the the renewal of expanded Medicaid and the switch in New Hampshire from the private insurance markets to the managed care model that the other folks currently on Medicaid are under, that there may be some pretty significant cuts in terms of reimbursements to providers who have clients that are part of that expanded Medicaid. So that's an additional concern as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's still one of the most significant issues in the state, absolutely. But I think some people were at least relieved to see that it hasn't spiked significantly since the previous year, but it's still 487. That's the highest in a decade.
And one of the things that we learned was that fentanyl, again, was the biggest cause of overdoses.
Yeah.
And, you know, fentanyl has been a major problem, right, because it is significantly stronger than heroin. It is harder to reverse through Narcan, and that has been a really big struggle. People on the street think that they're getting heroin, and it's laced with fentanyl. It's significantly stronger than they think, and that's what leads to overdoses.
And just yesterday, Senators Maggie Hassan and Jeanne Shaheen announced that more money's on the way to New Hampshire to fight this opioid epidemic. The state will get a lump sum of $23 million, and then providers, stakeholders can apply for that funding. Hassan says the goal is to get it out by September.
We have gotten the administration and members of both parties to acknowledge that states that have the highest mortality rate should get their fair share of the money. And with that foundation set, we think we can move forward and continue to do this work.
Hassan speaking to NHPR's Rick Ganley on Morning Edition, who she also said that this money should help increase medication-assisted treatment for opioid addiction.
What we hear most of all from providers on the front line is we need more medication-assisted treatment. This should help us really expand those efforts and expand our prevention and recovery efforts, too.
So it seems like, Dean, this is something that the state has been waiting for a while.
Something that our congressional delegation has worked very hard on. When it was initially announced that there'd be an increase in federal funding, the concern for our delegation was that the money was going to be distributed based on a population basis rather than a per capita mortality basis. So, you know, New Hampshire's a small state, very high per capita, but much larger states have more numbers of overdoses and fatality. So the concern was initially by the original formula, we were only going to get a couple million dollars, and they've pushed, Senator Shaheen and Hassan pushed very hard to sort of have it recalculated the way money is awarded. And so, you know, the per capita, the top states, I think, have been Ohio, West Virginia, and New Hampshire, and a few others. So that this is obviously something they worked very hard for.
Trent?
To Dean's point, this fight has been going on since 2015. Yeah. This is Senator Ayotte originally got the Cures Act through, and the problem was there was no money behind it, right? We got about $3 million annually, which was the smallest possible grant that a state could get. And so this fight has been going on for members of both parties now, and it's just been, despite all of the talk and all the rhetoric coming out of Washington, it's just been very difficult to get actual money behind the problem. And even, you know, in this case where we're talking about $26 million, all of that has to be spent, I think, by the end of this year. You know, in terms of a total amount of money being spent on the problem, it's not a huge amount.
Mm. Always more resources needed, it seems,
right,
for this kind of fight. Let's talk about one more thing before the break, and that is voting. Democrats are getting behind a proposal by State Senator Kevin Kavanaugh to broadly expand the use of absentee ballots in New Hampshire by including forecasts of bad weather as a legal reason to request one. Trent, what's the motivation behind this effort?
Well, so right now, you can get an absentee ballot for four reasons. If you're going to be out of town on election day, if there's a religious holiday on election day, you can't vote because of a disability, or you have some kind of employment obligation. What happened in the town of Ringe, where I have once voted, was that they saw that a snowstorm was coming, and so they urged people to get absentee ballots so that they, in case they didn't want to drive to the polls during the snowstorm, they wouldn't have to do that. Here's the problem. That's not one of the reasons allowed under the law to get an absentee ballot. Now, no one's checking, right, to make sure, well, did you really work because you got that absentee ballot? But what some state senators would like to do is make that an option now.
and perhaps that'll get through, or is there a lot of Republican opposition?
There's going to be some pushback. You know, some Republicans have said that it's a sort of a quick and easy way to avoid dealing with a larger issue of who should ultimately make those decisions. We had that debate in the last legislative session about the extent to which, you know, Bill Gardner has, our Secretary of State, has final say over when people vote, and he's been very strict about wanting town clerks to hold votes even in bad weather. So I think this is a debate that's going to continue. It's certainly something Democrats are rallying around, but I don't know what its prospects are longer term.
And finally, let's talk about ranked choice voting, because the state of Maine gave it a chance this week on Tuesday. And as it turns out, they're going to certify or at least start counting the votes today. Dean, how does ranked choice voting work?
Mm-hmm. Well, the way ranked choice voting works is that you have an election, and if nobody gets a majority, you drop the lowest candidate. And when you go in to vote, you get to choose you get to rank order your preferences. Of the three candidates, you go in and you vote first candidate, second candidate, third candidate. Then they tally the votes. And if nobody has a majority, they drop the third candidate. And then that candidate's second choice votes are redistributed to the other candidate. So it's a multi-phase process in which you keep doing that. If there are four or five candidates, you keep going through that iteration until you have somebody who has a majority. So it requires more of an investment from voters to kind of be able to rank order their preferences. And it takes a little bit longer to tabulate the winners as well. And it's been something that's been tried in Maine was just tried for the primary. Voters also voted to now use it ongoing for the general election. And there is some research out there that I've seen that shows that if ranked choice voting had been used in the last gubernatorial election, Paul LePage, the controversial Republican governor, would have lost. The problem was there was an independent candidate and a Democratic candidate. They split the anti-LePage vote. And some people believe that this is kind of a way now to kind of get around that issue in the future, to not have a spoiler.
Yeah, and worth mentioning that Governor LePage threatened not to certify the vote, and he's called ranked choice voting, we're going to quote here, the most horrific thing in the world. So that's from Governor LePage there. Most horrific thing in the world, ranked choice voting. But listeners, if you have a comment about ranked choice voting, send us an email. We'd love to hear from you on this. exchange@nhpr.org is the email address. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're going to be talking about the Manchester VA in just a moment. The task force report is finally out. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Did you know a tiny piece of moon rock is embedded in stained glass at the Washington National Cathedral? Or that you can visit a 400-year-old bonsai tree at the National Arboretum? Washington, D.C. is brimming with incredible sights and historic monuments, and you and a friend could be on your way. Simply make a gift to NHPR today to support the news you trust and the programs you love, and you'll be automatically entered to win. But don't wait. We're giving away this trip on Saturday. Give now at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, and Trent Spinner of The Union Leader. Listeners, give us a call if you have questions about the week's news or comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email works too, exchange@nhpr.org. And remember, you can watch a video of this radio show in progress at NHPR Exchange on Facebook. And we wanted to let you know about a conversation we've scheduled for Monday. It's part of our Race for the First series. Host Laura Kanoy is sitting down with the candidates running in New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. And on Monday, we'll be speaking with Republican Andy Sanborn. What questions do you have for him? Send them in now to exchange@nhpr.org. And remember, you can listen back to all of the interviews in this series at nhpr.org or subscribe to the Exchange podcast wherever you get your podcasts. So this week, the long-awaited final report from the task force that spent months looking at the future of VA healthcare for veterans in New Hampshire was approved. Acting Secretary Peter O'Rourke put a stamp of approval on all 29 recommendations in the report. Key among them was an emphasis on culture change. The task force acknowledged that culture was a big part of the problems that came to light last year. Whistleblowers alleged that delays in necessary care had caused suffering among patients. Other recommendations in this report include combining the VA clinics in Somersworth and Portsmouth, establishing an ambulatory surgical center, investing in mental health services, and increasing the number of beds at the VA's community living center. Those hoping for a full-service hospital like the one in White River Junction, Vermont, were disappointed by this report, but it does advocate for full services for veterans through partnerships with the private sector. Veterans had indicated in surveys that they wanted services closer to home, and so the VA, in this report, is essentially announcing its intention to deliver just that. So I went to the Manchester VA recently, yesterday, and I spoke with Dave Kenny about the report. He was the co-chair of what was known as the VA New Hampshire Vision 2025 Task Force. Let me ask you about the buildings here. At the beginning of the process, there were a lot of folks, especially the whistleblowers, who were really hoping to have a lot of construction here. And in this final report, there are some things that will be built, right? There's the talk of an ambulatory center. There's also talk of, you know, beefing up mental health care, not necessarily here, but in the community in Manchester somewhere. And there's also talk of adding beds at the community living center here. Are these all set in stone, or are these sort of aspirational goals that if there's funding and if the larger VA system approves it, it'll go forward?
It's probably a little bit of both. I mean, like anything else, you know, the proof is with the funding. And so, you know, the first step, of course, being that the VA has essentially embraced what we've asked them to take a look at as part of our findings and recommendations. But in addition to that, I don't think anything or any path forward is etched in stone. I think as you go and you look at certain things, there may be some adjustments that need to be made along the way with regards to, you know, even constructing new space.
Talk a little bit about culture, because this task force report says that cultural problems here at the Manchester VA led up to some of the problems that exploded last July. So talk about culture and how the task force hopes to be able to address it.
Sure. Well, the task force, in the beginning, we knew that there were some cultural issues that had been mentioned to us, and a lot of it revolved around, as I understand it, communication among the staff themselves. Truthfully, you know, coming into the center myself, you see interactions with the clinicians and the doctors to the patients, and it's second to none. Patients are smiling around here, and it's very forthright, and it's very gregarious, and you just think, wow, this is great. They're treating their patients like they're gold. And so, you know, from the outside, one would think, no, there couldn't possibly be a culture crisis here, but in fact there was. And a lot of it had to do with the intercommunication, I think, between the clinicians, the nursing staff, the doctors, and so forth. And so that had to be improved. We've been very fortunate to have Director Montoya here, who had already started that process when he came here last July. And one of the things, of course, was to engage the staff in making decisions, to take a look and listen to the staff about what their concerns were, what their issues were, how to make certain improvements. But in Director Montoya's case, it wasn't just about listening to the staff, but it was also about walking around the facility, being a presence, actually being accessible to the clinicians and to the staff, and listening to them one-on-one about what their issues are and what their concerns are, but then actually taking those concerns and doing something about it. That really is the key. And I think that is also the key with what this report will yield. It's not just about what we've released today in terms of what we've recommended. Now I think what we're going to see is what's it going to look like a year from now? You know, how much progress has been made in all of these 29 points that have come out of the report?
How much progress do you think you would need to see a year from now to feel like your time spent on this task force has been justified?
Things that don't cost a lot of money, I think, those should certainly be prioritized, and it can be prioritized because it doesn't require any kind of special approval process, if you will, to get those things done. Things like culture, for example, a lot of those things can be done internally. And so part of that change has to be culture, but also part of it has to be additional staffing. you know, the ability, for example, to have more doctors in specialties so that when a doctor goes on vacation or has to go somewhere else within the network, perhaps to facilitate care, that there is another doctor here to hold appointments. And that's been part of the complaints that the veterans have had in terms of, even in some cases with specialty care, I call my doctor, but he or she's not there, and I've got to wait longer now to get an appointment. So those are the kinds of things I want to see changes in. So staffing really is a key part of that, as well as culture. And then, of course, I'm certainly hoping to see some progress in construction.
One of the recommendations here that was accepted, they were all accepted, but one of them was making sure that veterans get the right care at the right time, which seems to be the crux of many of the complaints that emerged last July. Certain veterans weren't getting the right care at the right time, and allegedly they suffered as a result. Do you feel the VA has enough resources to make good on that promise, giving the right care at the right time?
I think so. You know, in Manchester, you know, when you have a crisis like we had last year here, where you had a lot of cultural things going on, you had people that were unhappy here, and then of course you had the major flood, which created a huge challenge for everyone here, not just the administrative staff. Look, that can be very you know, demeaning for a lot of folks having to work here and having to work in that environment where it's just it seems like it's one crisis after another. But I think, you know, as we look at it now, a lot of that has changed dramatically. And part of that has to do with the leadership. Leadership taking change seriously and actually making it happen. It changes how people deal with each other here in terms of the communications issue, which I had mentioned earlier. That's key. And when you get people inside engaged in making change, it's amazing what can happen. And it doesn't necessarily require a lot of monetary resources. Sometimes it's just changing how you do things that makes a difference.
Well, Dave Kenny, thank you very much for speaking with me.
I appreciate it, Peter. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's Dave Kenny, co-chair of what was known as the VA New Hampshire Vision 2025 Task Force. Dean Spiliotis, yeah. Your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, the bigger picture here is that the VA is a massive, one of the most massive federal bureaucracies that we have, and changing bureaucratic culture, whether it's among the people on the ground in the hospital or in the broader administration nationally, is a challenge for sure. And we've seen, this is not unique to New Hampshire. We've seen VA hospitals in other states have pretty significant problems. And you know, the political context here is that there's a bit of a debate among Democrats and Republicans about whether to invest more money into the actual hospital system or work increasingly to give veterans other options or choice throughout the surrounding communities. And I think what we're seeing here is an attempt to kind of strike a balance, provide more resources, try to change the bureaucratic culture, but also make sure that the veterans can have other options in the surrounding community and make that kind of back and forth between, you know, VA facilities and surrounding community facilities a little more seamless in terms of treatment and follow-up.
Seems like the trend is to get veterans into the community, yeah. Places closer where they live, and major developments on that separately from this task force report this week. Governor Sununu signed a bill into law that made his executive order from last year permanent. That executive order suspended state licensing requirements for federally licensed VA doctors so they can practice in space loaned to the VA by private health care providers. So not necessarily like permanently installing a VA doctor at, say, Catholic Medical Center, but right. If they need to do a colonoscopy or something like that, they can actually borrow a room at CMC and do the procedure there. That law is now permanent and seems like it might be a good thing for the governor especially.
Yeah, it's certainly a way to say, you know, you're working on solving the problems for veterans, but it's just basically the larger goal here, as I was just suggesting, is to provide, you know, greater continuity of care and to avoid the kind of bureaucratic breakdowns that you sometimes end up with.
It seems like a slam dunk. When this first came about, I had no idea that you could be a doctor somewhere, you could be in the VA system, but then you have to do a whole other process to be able to practice in New Hampshire. And it just seemed like, you know, one of Sununu's things that he's campaigned on and that he's really tried to do as governor is cut all this bureaucratic stuff. And I was just surprised that this even existed in the first place.
Well, there hadn't been necessarily a need for it, at least not an identified need, but here it is.
Here it is.
Yeah. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and still to come on the program, a discussion of education funding. Some property-poor towns are challenging the way the state relies on property taxes to fund most of its public education. Tell us how you feel about our education funding system. How do you feel about your property taxes going towards it? The number is 1-800-892-8255.
6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page where you can watch a video of us having this radio show, NHPR Exchange. So Trent, the Union Leader reported this week on Manchester's new police chief, Carlo Capano, and he was the only candidate for the job.
Carlo Capano is the new Manchester police chief. He'll take over in a few weeks, replacing Nick Willard, who will most likely become the new U.S. Marshal for New Hampshire. Capano has been around. He has served his entire career at the Manchester Police Department. He's worked his way up the ranks. He was very close with Chief Willard, and they worked together on a number of big, high-profile cases. He was most recently the assistant chief and was behind a lot of technology upgrades, a lot of new ways of policing, and has been recognized within both within and outside the department as being a pretty smart guy who understands community policing. And so he was unanimously approved by the alderman and mayor. A story that we recently did was just looking at how other places hire police chiefs. Mm-hmm. In Manchester, they have always, I mean, going back through Chief Willard, Chief Mara, going back a dozen chiefs, have always picked somebody from inside the department. And so we decided this time we wanted to take a look at how some other communities do it. And so we called places that were very similar in size, cities that were very similar in size, including the hometown of the police commissioner, Scott Spradling, to see how they did it. And what we found was that most of those other departments did an external search. They did a national search, and they brought in a number of candidates, three or four candidates. There were community forums. The public had an opportunity to ask questions. And there was just a more extensive process. In this case, we had to do a right-to-know request to find out how many people actually applied. Because we were getting those press releases like, you know, he was the best candidate. We found out there was only one person who applied, Carlo Capano. And in no way did the story mean to criticize him personally in any way or his qualifications. It was just a look at how Manchester does it versus all these other communities that decided that they wanted to do a national search.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the balance there obviously is the concern that potentially you may end up with kind of an insularity in terms of how the department functions versus bringing in fresh ideas from the outside. The other hand is kind of an institutional and community knowledge. Capano has been in Manchester Force for 22 years, assistant chief for 3 years. He's talked a lot about kind of furthering these ideas of community, having more resources out in the community, which is a common trend these days among our police force. So that's the balance, is kind of the sort of knowledge of the community versus bringing in some other people with outside ideas.
And you got to understand, I mean, Manchester Police Chief is probably one of the most prominent. It is, I think, the most prominent law enforcement job in the state. It's the state's largest city. It is on the forefront of the opioid epidemic. I think that Chief Willard, using social media, took what was a pretty administrative job and basically put himself on the front of almost every issue, sometimes topics that maybe he realized later he didn't want to get involved with. But, this is a big job in the state, especially right now. And so that was some of the feedback we heard from people was, why isn't Manchester looking around more? And people weren't saying that Chief Capano wasn't qualified in any way, but just taking a look at how other places do it.
And you can find more stories about Capano at our website, nhpr.org. He's talked extensively about how he's going to make the opioid crisis one of his top priorities. Check that out, nhpr.org. One more story to discuss really quickly here before the break, and that's that power companies, including Eversource, are thinking of getting into the water business. Trent, what's the business incentive to do that?
So this is interesting. So Eversource, because of, and I won't get into all the details because I know we're short on time, but Eversource has a couple $100 million in money that they, because they had to sell their power plants, they now need to essentially find a way to put that money to work. And what they've said is, look, we understand how to deliver critical services. We understand a heavily regulated market. We understand how to deal with customers and send bills and read meters. So what other industries can we get involved in? And one of those is water, because the water industry is very similar to the electric industry in terms of regulation and just how you have to do the business model in general. So Eversource is looking at buying a Connecticut, a couple of other. They have one water company in New Hampshire. They're looking at buying another water company.
Yeah, they bought Aquarian in Connecticut. Now they're looking at buying Connecticut Water.
Mm-hmm. And so it's just for them, it's a way to put their capital back to work, and it's something that fits within their business plan.
Mm-hmm. And worth mentioning that Don Kreis, the ratepayer advocate in New Hampshire, says these forays into water are risky, essentially because we could have one investor-owned utility, quoting him, one investor-owned utility in New Hampshire that serves everybody who uses electricity, natural gas, and water. That's a lot of responsibility for one company.
That's a lot of responsibility for one company. And then what happens if something goes wrong?
Exactly. Yeah, what happens then? I mean, maybe that's what the ratepayer advocate's job is supposed to do, sort of predict the worst-case scenario. But are there massive alarm bells going off here, or are people just basically watching and saying, oh, this is interesting?
I think people are watching and saying that it's interesting. I mean, the Aquarian deal, which closed last year, it seems like there's no major change. I think that people who are Aquarian customers really didn't even notice a difference. But I think as Eversource expands into other places in the state, you know, it'll definitely be something to watch.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. Circling back to our conversation about the VA just a moment ago, we got a comment from Jerry in Dover who says, although since I have TRICARE insurance and I do not have to utilize healthcare through the VA, when I needed to schedule my yearly visit, I have gotten appointments quickly. During my visits, I have found their facilities to be clean, their personnel professional, and I have experienced none of the problems that have been publicized in the media. Thanks very much for your comments, Jerry. We really appreciate it. If you have comments about the week's news, send them by email, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello, here with Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences, and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and we're broadcasting a video of today's radio show at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Give us a call to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We'll learn more about education funding in just a few. This is The Exchange. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. Give us a call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. And joining us now on the program by phone is Lola Dufour of the Concord Monitor. Lola, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Lola, you were writing this week about how property poor towns are thinking of suing the state over the state's reliance on property taxes for the bulk of its education funding. Explain to us, what is the problem from those towns' perspective?
So those towns would probably tell you that this thing called stabilization aid is the straw that broke the camel's back. Basically, the last time the state did a major retooling of its adequacy formula, that's the formula that it uses to dole out education aid, it took out about $160 million in targeted aid that really helped the neediest districts, and that's because they had a very low property tax base and also a high rate of poverty. And there were other things that kind of added up to that $160 million, but those are the two biggest things. And when it did this, it put in this kind of hold harmless grant program called stabilization so that there wasn't this big overnight $160 million shortfall. And in 2015, they decided to sunset that program. And so I think we're in the third year of reductions, of 4% annual reductions to stabilization aid. And so places like Franklin and Pittsfield and Berlin are starting to say we're getting pretty close to having nothing left to lose. And so that's why some are increasingly openly talking about suing.
So nothing left to lose, meaning they might as well sue because they're not getting what they need from the state any other way?
Yeah, and because they're saying, you know, Franklin, for example, its high school is on warning from its accreditor, and it's specifically on warning from its accreditor because of funding. Berlin is saying we're eventually going to just have to declare bankruptcy. So that's the state that some of these communities are in.
And Andrew Walensky, who was at the meeting you attended this week, said to you that more important than a lawsuit possibly would be meetings like the one you attended because people don't actually understand how it works. What does he think people don't understand that they should understand?
Well, that was John Tobin.
Oh, forgive me.
Not Andrew Walensky. Yeah, but I'm Belinsky would probably agree with that. But yeah, John Tobin is the one who is actually would be one of the lawyers suing Belinsky, saying, since I'm an office holder, I promise not to sue, although I'll hold as many of these meetings as I want. Yeah, I think a big part of their strategy right now is this public education campaign, because they want people to understand that property taxes are they're regressive. And that means that they want people to understand that if there are constant cuts and budget crises in certain communities, it's not because they don't manage their money well. It's because if you don't have much of a tax base, you need to tax at a higher rate to raise more money. And also, if you're a small community, it's harder to achieve things like economies of scale, et cetera. So they want people to understand that the deck is stacked against these communities and that it's a structural problem, not a problem of mismanagement.
And at the meeting you attended, was there broad support for a lawsuit against the state?
I think it's hard to know. At one point, Berlin's business administrator, the school district business administrator, said, we're ready to sue. Like, how do we do this? There was a round of applause from across the room. So I'd say people are getting pretty bullish. But I think it's hard to say if people really are ready to go. I think that's still an open question.
Go ahead.
I think a lot of these communities are still holding out hope for a legislative solution.
We have some tape of Brian Lemurian, a business manager for Berlin Public Schools. He had questions at the education funding public meeting this week. Let's hear from him.
One, why did the state decide to start taking stabilization away from us in 2015? And two, how can we work collaboratively now to start a lawsuit? Because we're ready to go.
So you can hear the enthusiasm in his voice. He's ready to take the state on, and again, challenging the state's efforts to provide some kind of stabilization doesn't seem to be working for him.
Yeah, I mean, stabilization accounts for, I think he had said, like a third of Berlin schools' budget. And Berlin is also, I think, has the highest tax rate in the state and one of the smallest property bases per student. So they're also, they're in the worst shape, or they're in one of the worst shapes. So it makes sense that you would be hearing that level of commitment from Berlin, and other communities, I think, aren't quite there yet.
So as the story unfolds, what's the next development that you're going to be looking for, Lola Dufour?
I am going to be looking at this legislative committee. About 2 years ago, when conversation about stabilization first started happening, Rick Ladd, who's the Republican House Education Chairman, said, I'm extremely sympathetic and I don't think adequacy is adequate. Adequacy is, again, the mechanism that the state uses for doling out aid. And so he set up this legislative study committee that is looking at the whole formula. And that's been meeting for about a year, and they have a report due out in November. And I know the people that are thinking about suing are also going to be watching this committee. I wouldn't say that there is a lot of hope from these towns that this committee will do what they think they need them to do. But I think I don't expect that any action will be taken before their report is out and they see what the appetite is from legislators. Next session is, I think they're going to be watching the elections in November, and seeing if this, gets to the top of the heap in terms of legislative priorities.
We get this email from Anne in Gilmanton, Lola. I'll ask you to comment on this. Anne wrote, "Ever since I was on our local school board in the 1980s, I've been keenly aware of how unfair it is to subsidize our schools mostly by the local property tax, which is only proportionate to the ability to pay in the moment that one buys property. Even 1 year later, one's ability to pay might have changed. It also disadvantages those who inherit family property but are unable to keep it due to high property taxes, and truly disadvantages those who put their own work into the property to improve it, only to have it reach an assessment level so high that they can't afford the taxes on it. In addition, paying for high costs of individual special ed cases, which in my opinion is the moral and just thing to do, gets very personalized when it has to be done through local property taxes, and continues in that vein. But perhaps these are arguments that you are familiar with that maybe people other than Anne have been sharing at these meetings.
Yeah, I mean, I've been covering schools for about 2 years in New Hampshire, and that's the argument you hear everywhere, is that individuals can't afford these property taxes, and that communities as a whole, especially in property poor communities, can't afford these taxes, that they get in the way of economic development in places like Berlin and Franklin, where the tax rate is super high. So, businesses don't want to come in, so the actual value of properties don't go up, et cetera, et cetera.
Lola Dufour is a reporter for the Concord Monitor, and you can find a link to her report on education and property taxes at nhpr.org. Lola, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Give us a call if you've got questions about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We've got time for a few more stories today, one of which has to do with the Fish and Game Commission, because it voted last month to increase the number of permits for live capture of snowshoe hares, these cute little bunnies. It also extended the season for trapping and the area in which they can be trapped. And some people are saying, hey, why are we doing this to this animal? Trent, why are we doing this? What are hares used for? Why are they trapped?
Good question. And this is kind of a story that we've been seeing. This is one aspect of a story that we've been seeing, I think, for the last decade, of this kind of old New Hampshire versus new New Hampshire. Old New Hampshire, which was, live free or die, and hunting and fishing and
trapping.
Right? And now animal rights activists are saying, well, why are we doing this? And so we've seen other instances of this with the bear baiting in 2015, bear baiting with chocolate. There was that intense debate over the bobcat hunt in 2016. Yep. And now this is kind of the newest front on that. And so basically what happens is you can trap hares, and they're using all kinds of different ways. I mean, there are contests where you can have hunting dogs catching them, and all kinds of other things. And so they expanded the people's ability to do this recently. And there's a meeting, it's actually today, where to discuss whether this should be allowed. And so there are people who are very opposed to this, who say that it's unfair to the animals, and that
unfair, to put it mildly. The other people would say it's downright cruel.
It's downright, yes.
Yeah.
It's animal abuse. And then there are other people who say this is a very traditional practice, and that we've been doing this.
Yeah, I did not know there are five beagle clubs in the state that actually do this hare hounding, where you the live release, and then it's a way to either do like a field trial or training. And I think the meeting today is the administrative rules could in theory be changed to prevent this. And so they're activists are encouraging a lot of attendance to oppose or to try to affect the change or have the rules rolled back.
Well, we're gonna, I guess, have to wait and see what the meeting yields, whether or not this practice continues, or at least the expansion will stand. There's one more animal story that we should talk about this week. It's a little more uplifting, and Trent, I'll let you tell the bulk of it, but it has to do with the woman from Nashua who had her little dog, Shih Tzu, stolen from her car, and she went to great lengths to get this dog back. What happened?
Our Nashua reporter, Kim Houghton, had a great lead on the story. She wrote, "Never mess with a Gate City woman and her 25-pound Shih Tzu." What happened was this woman, Lily Martinez, her dog went missing. It turned out that it was stolen, and she went to the police. And they, started an investigation. But, Nashua police, they're pretty busy. There's a lot going on in the city, and a missing small dog wasn't the highest priority. So she actually went to Facebook, and she started posting pictures of the potential suspect, of her dog, and people saw it, and people shared. And I've seen these on Facebook, like a missing animal thing will get shared tens of thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in her case. And so she was able to essentially develop leads to figure out where her dog was. She tracked it down to a guy in Methuen to his house. She went there and got her dog back. He was later arrested on several charges, both in connection with the dog, and he had some outstanding warrants.
Yeah.
He was a bad person, and she was able to get her dog back.
Well, I mean, let's unpack that last part of it, because she went to she had an idea that this guy stole her dog, and she just went to his house.
In Methuen.
Did she go with any police escort of any kind or safety? Because that sounds like a very dangerous situation, right?
Yes, and police were not happy about this, right?
That she went by herself to do this?
Right. I mean, to just find somebody on Facebook and to essentially go to his house and try and confront him over a stolen dog. I mean, in this story, it ended up fine, right? She got her dog back. No one was hurt. But that could have potentially led to a bad situation.
Yeah, I will say one small detail is that the dog was stolen from her car, which was running unlocked with the air conditioning on. And I'm just in general, whether the window's down or the AC's on or whatever, I'm not a big fan of people leaving dogs in cars. It's a recipe for these kinds of problems. You know, I have dogs. Dogs love riding in cars, but I don't typically leave them in the cars by themselves, whether the air conditioning's on or it's unlocked or what have you. And so that's what precipitated it. She ran in to do something, left the dog in the car running, AC on, I think unlocked, and the guy took the dog.
And she did say in one of her Facebook posts, she says she learned a difficult lesson about leaving her dog in a vehicle. Let me just say that I'm kicking myself for it.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in general, like, let's say she walked there and tied the dog up outside. Like, there is a market.
I'm not a big fan of that either, but that's another conversation.
Right, because there's a market for people to,
absolutely,
an incentive to steal dogs and then sell them somewhere else on Craigslist. I mean, it's not like this guy, well, maybe he was, but let's say odds are he was thinking not as a pet and companion for him, but as a way to profit. You know, and that's something that dog owners probably should be aware of.
And he had warrants out for his arrest on other things. So when the Methuen police eventually went to go get him and talk to him about this dog, they ended up bringing the SWAT team. They called out the SWAT team, and they evacuated neighbors.
Yeah, the pictures in Union Leader, it's like, this is military-grade stuff.
Right.
The dog had already been retrieved. They're not using tanks to go in there and get the Shih Tzu,
right,
but to get this guy who had barricaded himself in. So anyway, scary story, but a good ending overall. For lesson learned, not just for this woman in Nashua, but for all of us, to be mindful of where our pets are, especially if we leave them unattended for a short period of time in public. Quickly before we go, I want to ask you, Trent, and then you, Dean, what stories are you going to be following in the coming week?
Interesting today, Katie McQuaid, our Scene columnist in Manchester, is writing about how the gay pride flag will be hanging over Manchester City Hall for the first time in its history. We'll have that in tomorrow's Union Leader.
Okay, and Dean, what about you?
We're in full midterm election mode at this point. It's what everybody's talking about in the political community in the state. Pretty soon it'll be 4th of July. Everybody will be marching in parades, and it's the official kickoff of the summer campaign season.
All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for being on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks also to Lola Dufour of the Concord Monitor for joining us earlier. That is it for today, and you can find the link to all the stories we discussed at nhpr.org. And you can continue the conversation online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and our intern is Abigail Sleeper. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.